Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Hey there, it's Mariah. I just wanted to give an extra trigger warning for this week's episode. This week, we will be having conversations about sexual violence, sexual assault, and abuse. So please, listener discretion is advised. Thanks for joining us today on another episode of Body to Burial. I'm Mariah.
And I'm Nikki.
We're just two regular true crime junkies who decided it was time to see crime from a new perspective. This is Body to Burial. I always feel like, and go.
And scene.
All right, Nikki. It's our, what time is it? It's like our mid-afternoon record session.
Isn't it nice?
So for today, though, let's move into this one because I am excited about this one because I didn't technically know that this was a specialty.
Okay.
But our guest today is Susan, and Susan is a forensic nurse, which basically is someone who provides care to victims of violence by doing like the medical forensic exam.
Okay.
This is the individual that is going to go through the process of administering a rape kit, collecting your clothes, like all of that stuff, which I didn't realize. And maybe this is just like, cause I'm naive and I don't really understand like hospital structures. I just thought it was like a regular nurse. So I'm curious to see like, if there's different education courses, like supplemental, that they have to take to like be certified or if they're certified or what?
Well, you got to think like they got to be like one of those souls that is very compassionate and sensitive because they kind of need that in that moment.
Yeah. Did you ever watch Private Practice, the spinoff from Grey's Anatomy?
No, I wasn't a real big Grey's Anatomy fan. I tried it.
Oh my God. Okay.
I know. Well,
there was a spinoff and one of the doctors gets sexually assaulted in her office.
Okay.
I think it was a patient. But anyways, it was a pretty like intense television portrayal of like a rape.
Okay.
And then afterwards they like show her having an interaction with a forensic nurse because they're like taking her clothes and putting it in bags and taking her underwear and like scraping under the fingernails, like that sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It was such a sad episode and like a sad scene because it's just like I couldn't imagine ever being like that vulnerable and scared.
Yeah.
And like
I would just want to forget the whole thing.
Yeah. And I don't know how I would react if I was on the other end of that. Like, do you say anything? Are you just quiet? Like, because the mood in the room is not like cheerful.
I would assume because it is an ongoing investigation, like I would assume you can't really like get too personal, you can't really say too much because it would be maybe an investigation, but I don't know.
But it's like, I wonder if they do though, are they trying to extract some information so that they can relay that to police officers because it's easier? Like, cause here's the reality for me, like if I was sexually assaulted in a manner that required that, I would want to talk to another girl about, like, I wouldn't feel comfortable telling a doctor what had happened to me. But like you said, I don't, maybe they can't have them say anything. And is there like another person in the room, like just watching?
Yeah,
this
I would
taking
think
place?
So. I would think they'd have to, because it's just like now where they have, like, have you ever gone in for like your gyno, whatever,
yes,
pap exam?
Yes.
And then they're like, okay, I'm going to bring my assistant in. And they like hang out. That's just kind of how it is now.
Yeah, they have to cover their bases.
Yeah. I thought it was a little bit odd when that first started happening, when I was going to like my gyno exam. I'm like, I'm already dying with the one person in here. And now I got a looker.
See, I never thought it was weird because get ready to have your mind blown. I've never had girl gynecologists. I always have a male. So they always bring in another person. But like,
really?
I don't want a girl gynecologist because I feel like then they're judging my vagine. I know you love when I say vagina.
Oh, please. So it makes me feel,
because it's just like going anywhere else where you're just like,
What?
Or she's like going to be judging you. I don't know. I feel more comfortable with a boy down there because I'm like, yeah, he sees a billion. Like, I can't imagine he's like real.
And what if you have like a super funky one and now he's told all of his doctor friends?
I mean, I don't know. I hope not. I hope mine's normal. That there's nothing to tell.
Oh my God.
But I will put the disclaimer that when I did become pregnant,
okay,
I did switch to a female OB for delivery because I didn't want a male telling me that like, you can do this when it's like, you've never done this. So you can't tell me at all what I'm feeling. So totally random, and that's a little known fact about me.
That is literally the weirdest thing I've ever heard. See, I've just literally never really thought about it. I didn't care. I had a guy and a girl deliver because I had switched insurance people when I had my second. So I couldn't have my first one, but I would have had my first one because he gets his haircut at my salon and and then, he delivered all my friends' babies. So then after, you know, the baby, I'd still see him. Like, hey.
See, that's awkward to me. That's awkward to me. I would never want to see those people ever again. I mean, we got severely off topic here, but no. So, I mean, yeah, I guess in this circumstance too, like, I just wouldn't want a male forensic nurse. But enough about me and my oddities. Let me get Susan on with us so we can figure out all about forensic nursing.
Okay, great. I'm just really afraid that there's going to be a lot of vagie.
I think there's going to be some body talk. So
okay. I'm just going to buckle up for
just
that.
Just prepare yourself for that.
Hi, this is Susie.
Hey, Susie, it's Mariah Hamilton.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good.
Awesome. Susie, this is Nikki. Nikki, this is Susie.
Hi.
Hi, Nikki.
Thank you so much for joining us and taking the time to speak with us. We're really excited to learn more about forensic nursing. What I like to do is usually have our guests try to explain their job in a very basic way.
Sure. So forensic nursing is an aspect, a specialty of nursing where we specifically treat and care for victims of crime, particularly crimes such as domestic violence, sexual assault, physical assault, gunshot wounds, stab wounds, and strangulation, things of that sort.
Okay. And then, so Nikki and I, we were chatting offline, and I guess this is just kind of like our ignorance about the nursing field. I didn't really understand that there was like a completely separate classification of nurses that did this. Like, I just always assumed when you showed up at the ER for one of those issues that just a nurse on the floor would see you, but that's incorrect. There seems like there's a class of like a group of you that are dedicated for those instances?
Yes. And it's funny you mentioned that because many nurses, as we're going to nursing school, don't realize about this specialty either. Sadly, we find out about it later. So we're trying to do a better job at introducing it in nursing school. But yes, there's a dedicated group of nurses, just like any other specialty, you know, cardiology, dermatology, labor and delivery, and that is forensics. And due to the nature of the crimes that are committed and the impact it has on the human, you know, the individual, both emotionally and physically, back in the, I believe, 70s, our pioneer of this specialty saw the intersection between nursing and the law as it pertains to these victims. And that's how the discipline grew. And so as nurses in this specialty, we receive extensive training on, you know, how to treat those victims, how to collect forensic evidence, photographs, testify in court, and some of those skills that aren't just second nature to a nurse or to medicine in general. And then, you know, taking into account the impact it's having on the person. So because we're nurses, you know, we have skills already in just dealing with trauma and emotions and being there for patients. And so it's a great blend of that criminal justice aspect, you know, as the patient goes through that and dealing with law enforcement and a crime that's been committed, and then caring for that patient through that journey. So it actually makes complete sense, you know, once we start to uncover what really forensic nursing is.
You kind of alluded to like there's different courses and accreditations. How much additional training do you go through?
So, you know, on top of just being an RN in general and receiving your nursing license and having some nursing experience, we then take up to 80 hours of initial training on content such as evidence collection, investigations, the court process, forensic photography, physical assessment, wounds, documenting, measuring those wounds. We do that. And then 300 or more hours of clinical experience with, you know, like a preceptor or another experienced forensic nurse. You know, then you've gained enough experience to see patients. From there, once you've acquired those, you can go to seek board certification.
Okay, well, let's walk through a rape victim. If they come in and they've been sexually assaulted, walk us through what happens.
Sure. So a patient would present to a hospital emergency department, typically either on their own, you know, driven by friends or whatever, or in the accompaniment of law enforcement. They are quickly checked into the emergency room and, you know, by a physician, quickly assessed if there's any urgent medical needs, extensive bleeding that requires suturing or something, in immediate concerns. So that's addressed. And then concurrently, then when it's determined that the patient is complaining of sexual assault, a forensic nurse is then paged. At that point, you know, we meet the patient, we explain our role. Everything that we offer or can do for the patient is by patient choice. Even if a patient comes in with law enforcement, she can refuse. Our care is guided by choice. So we'll come in and say, hi, you know, my name is Susie. I'm a forensic nurse and I am here to help you through this situation you're in. These are some things I can do. Are these things that you would like? And the patient, you know, most of the time says yes. But there have been times where like, no, I don't want this. I don't want to go through this. I just want to go home. And there they go.
Okay.
If they do consent, you know, then what that entails, it's about a 4 or 5 hour process.
Oh, wow.
You know, I'm taking care of that patient and that patient only.
Okay.
So we get an extensive history about what happened, which entails very detailed, intimate questions about what happened to them. And we try to warn our patients ahead of time, like, this is what we're going to be asking. You may or may not want, you know, your family member, mom, dad, boyfriend in the room. When we ask specifically, we will ask questions like, you know, so what happened? And tell us what happened. And they will go on, you know, like, well, I was walking down the street and this man approached me and hit me and then he raped me. And we can't stop with just that statement. We have to get details. So what does rape mean? What part of his body penetrated you? Was it his penis in your vagina? Was it his penis in your anus? Fingers? Was it his mouth? What part of the body was touched or assaulted? Very intimate. Where did he ejaculate? Yeah. Did he ejaculate? Was he wearing a condom? You know, like just details. So we gather that from the patient, the events, like what time, who was the assailant, you know, description of him if possible, or any names that they want to share. And then, you know, anything like that was shared or said, we try to gather direct quotes from the patient as much as possible and document that.
Is there a police officer or anybody else in the room while you're trying to get information about the assault?
Typically not.
Okay.
Typically not. The patient would have to give us permission to disclose anything like that to the police.
Okay.
But yeah, typically not. We do that alone behind closed doors.
Wow. So basically, is that part of your training, is to be able to relay that to the police as well?
Yeah. Yep. And how to, you know, deal with that, you know, as far as talking to the patient about those options, what is confidential, what isn't?
Yeah. Where is the line between something that has to be shared versus not?
So what has to be shared or reported to the authorities is anything that occurs to a minor child. So anyone under 18, okay, typically, because, you know, it's a child. And in certain statutes, like in Wisconsin, where I work, some things are reportable. Wounds that are, say, from a gunshot wound or a knife wound, those are reported to police. Typically, though, in those cases, police are already involved. So, you know, we don't have to navigate that. And then, of course, any cases of elder abuse or vulnerable adult abuse, those are all mandatory reporting situations. After she shares what happened to her, you know, verbally, you know, and we gain consent, like, okay, based on what you told me, complained of pain, in this area, you have vaginal pain, I can do an exam, a speculum exam to see if there's any injuries. I can collect evidence from that area. And this is what that would look like, feel like. I can give you medications to prevent sexually transmitted infections if you're concerned about that, given the risk. I can give you medications to prevent an unwanted pregnancy. Put that all out there for the patient and they decide. Because some patients, the last thing they want is, say, a speculum inserted after they just were assaulted. And understandably so. We work with that. We tell them the risks and benefits, like, hey, there might be some DNA and we might have a good chance of getting that with this exam. However, I understand you don't want a speculum inserted there. Totally get it. We can do this some other way. I can collect your underwear for any drainage. I can just insert Q-tips in your vaginal area and collect it that way. We call those blind swabs, where we're not seeing anything. We're just collecting.
Are those less accurate?
We're not able to visualize inside the vagina for, say, wounds. There's things called microtrauma that can occur inside the vagina from, you know, an assault or even from consensual sex, honestly. We can't tell by looking at somebody if they were assaulted. So that is one thing that people want to know, especially if they were, say, drugged and they don't know what happened and they just woke up. Mm-hmm. They're like, can you look at me and tell me what happened? And unfortunately, we can't. And that's simply because our vaginas are designed to tolerate that type of activity. It doesn't know that it's being assaulted, right? It doesn't know that there's no consent. So the vagina may not have any injuries, but at times there are microtraumas, little lacerations, gouges out of the vaginal wall from, say, a fingernail. As nurses trained in this, we can detect those by looking. So if we don't do an exam with a speculum, we may not see those items or those injuries, which doesn't make or break the case. Our crime lab would tell you that some of the most valuable evidence comes from underwear worn immediately after the assault because of gravity, right? Drainage and things. It's right up against the skin and the DNA just gets rubbed off right into the underwear. So I wouldn't say like a speculum exam or the swabs from that make or break a case.
Can I have you clarify, does that mean, like, did you take all of their clothes? Do you just take their underwear if they had underwear? Like, I've seen on television, and again, I don't know if this is an accurate representation, but, like, they kind of, like, scrape under fingernails. What does it mean when you're collecting evidence, and what does that all include?
So, yeah, those are great questions. So the nurse will determine, based on the history, where the best area of evidence would be. So if the patient says, I was vaginally assaulted, there was ejaculation, and I scratched him on the back, then the nurse will decide, okay, evidence to be collected would be vaginal swabs, under the fingernails, or anywhere else. So it's truly guided by the assault and the dynamics of the assault and what happened. There may be DNA evidence on her breasts because she reported that he was biting, licking her. There may be touch DNA because he had his hands around her neck and strangled her. So she will make those determinations about where the evidence should come from.
What is touch DNA?
So touch DNA is where the like assailant had his hands on the patient. There was no necessarily fluids, so no saliva, no semen, but just he had his hands on her. So say she reported, he grabbed me by the thighs and held my thighs with his hands as he assaulted me. And she didn't shower, right? So she came directly to us. Then there's a high likelihood that there is some touch DNA left from his hands there. If she says he touched me here and pointed to an area of her body, then we would just swab that area.
Okay. And hope anything could come up.
Correct. Yep. Just entirely based on history. There's a lot of factors that go into what may or may not be a possibility to collect. So like you mentioned her clothes, the most valuable piece, as I mentioned, that our crime lab has told us is that underwear that's immediately worn after. But depending on the history, you know, I've had patients where the assailant ejaculated on her shoes. I might want to collect those shoes. Now the patient also maybe not doesn't want to give up her shoes. They're like her favorite, like heels or Doc Martens or whatever, you know, and we don't have to take them. So some options are just to swab those shoes. Or we can use what's called a UV ultraviolet light or alternative light source, turn all the lights off, and we can fluoresce the clothes or fluoresce the patient. And if it fluoresces, that typically means there's some element of protein there. Could be semen. You know, could be saliva, and that will direct us exactly where to swab if needed.
I wanted to talk a little bit about the photography aspect that you mentioned, and I'm assuming that's kind of pretty equal to what we see on TV, where you're measuring bruises or scrapes or bite marks and photographing what those look like and where they're located on the body.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, and that's why we have training on it, because, you know, they need to be clear photographs and we need to photograph well. So each injury that we identify in that extensive head to toe exam that we will do, we will locate injuries that sometimes the patient is not even aware that they're there. And we'll say, okay, you know, here's this laceration or what have you, where did this come from? So we'll document what the patient says. Oh, that's where he grabbed me. And then we will measure it. And then we take photographs. If each injury gets three photographs, so one photograph from like far away to kind of orient what part of the body this is on. So if it's on your arm, you know, we want to take a picture so that you can clearly see, oh, look, that's her left arm. I see a laceration there. Then we take another photograph close up with a measuring device. It's ideal to use forensic measuring devices, so an AFBO ruler that's black and white. And then the third photo is an extreme close up without the measuring device so that the nature of the injury is seen. We can at times, you know, apply filters to our photographs to better enhance what we can see with the naked eye. Most nurses use a forensic camera system that allows us to take a photo with a really nice camera, like a DSLR, that we don't have to really futz with the settings. It comes with a macro lens and a ring flash, and it's just all ready to go, almost like a point and shoot, but better. And then it stores it for us in a very secure way so that those photographs, which are sensitive, don't get put, you know, in the medical record necessarily, are kept under lock and key, are only released to, say, law enforcement with a consent, to the DA only with a consent, because we want to be sure those photos, some of them are genital photos, we want to be sure that they are protected and that we maintain our patient's trust. In the event that, say, a prosecutor wants to view those photos, or a defense attorney, it's really a good practice to say, sure, you can view those in my office, is where I can explain what it is you're viewing. We don't want them necessarily to get into the hands of the defendant or portrayed in court if it's not needed.
I could see why, when you describe all that, why you wouldn't want a family member, or if this has just happened to you, how hard that would be to like have someone listening. Because I would think that maybe the whole truth wouldn't come out.
Right. And that is a consideration. Many times patients tell law enforcement one thing at the scene, and then once they're with us, they divulge more information. Like, yes, I was anally raped. Sometimes there's just too much shame to talk to some random male cop about what happened, or they feel responsible. There's a lot of self-blame, especially if there was drinking involved, or maybe I shouldn't have walked down that aisle, or I shouldn't have taken that ride from that guy, or whatever. To open up requires some rapport building that, again, as nurses, we're good at anyway.
Like, they would probably consider you as a comfort. They're having to say and do things that are uncomfortable, but it would be kind of more calming than to a cop.
We hope so. I mean, imagine, you know, from a sexual assault, the body is the crime scene. Well, then there's the evidence, the crime scene on the victim, the body. We have to, you know, look at how we can collect that. So imagine, you know, like a random cop trying to collect these sensitive swabs from, you know, vaginal area. It just wouldn't work, right? Or just wouldn't be the best experience at all. Or even a physician, for that matter, or someone who's just not trained in how to do it. It's more than a procedure.
Do they have someone come in later too, after you've done all that, like a therapist, a psychologist, or anything like that?
The best practice is to have a sexual assault or domestic violence advocate present. And in our state, in some states, ours in particular, it is a law that they are entitled to have an advocate present throughout the process. So whether that's during the exam, during the trial, during any depositions or charging conferences. The one thing I do like about the role is, you know, my patients come in and they are one way, you know, they're traumatized typically when they come in. And even though I didn't fix what happened or erase what happened. And I don't even know like what the criminal justice result's going to be because most of these never go to trial, right? There's just, that's just the nature of our criminal justice system and sexual assault. But they do leave my exam room a little better. They have a little color in their cheeks. They're walking upright, maybe crack a smile because we gave them their power back in giving them those choices and having somebody say, I'm sorry this happened to you, or I believe you. That's usually what they need to start that healing process.
Yeah. Yeah. Like when they would leave there, they would feel a little bit weight off their shoulders, just kind of even just getting it out and saying what happened.
Yes. And being supported and believed.
Yeah. Do you ever get to find out the conclusions of any of your cases?
It takes about a year or so for a patient, you know, once we see a patient, a year or so for it to reach, you know, say the trial. Sometimes, you know, we're like, oh, you know, like we'll get a subpoena to testify. And then we're like, okay, yep, I do remember this case. We'll go testify and then we'll leave. And then typically the prosecutor will reach back out and say, yep, we got a guilty verdict, or no, we didn't.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So sometimes we do find out, and that's good to know because it gives us some closure too. Like, oh, good. Yeah. You know, this one was bad, or, you know, thank goodness for this or whatever. So
yeah,
I'm a curious person just like by nature with anything. And that would kill me because I would need to know some sort of conclusion, you know?
Yes. And as nurses, we're very much like that too. So we want to know the results, but we don't always get it. We just try to know that the difference we're making is in that moment there, and that's what drives our work.
How many cases are you doing a day? Are there days where you have no one coming in?
Well, it depends on, you know, where a nurse works. So I work in Milwaukee, which is our largest city in Wisconsin. Last I checked, we saw close to 900 a year. There are times I'd see in an 8-hour shift. Well, probably more like a 10-hour shift, I would see 3 to 4 patients. If I said the average case is 4 to 5 hours long, that's not including the documentation afterwards. It can wear on a person if it's a busy program. In our rural areas, there's victims out there, but they're not necessarily coming in because it's just too far geographically or there's other barriers. Some programs or hospitals will only see maybe 5 a year. There's a lot of factors around that, but it really does depend on where you're practicing.
And is that just because maybe they're not just coming in?
Yeah, I believe it's more that access and barriers because the data shows that sexual assaults are happening. It's like 1 in 5.
Yeah.
But not everyone presents for forensic exam because 1, they might not know about it. 2, there might be misconceptions about what that means. Forensic services aren't really marketed by hospitals as much like, you know, their new cardiac robot.
Yeah.
So it's not like a thing that people like talking about. It's usually through word of mouth or through law enforcement. So I think that those are big barriers.
I mean, I've seen it on kind of special victims unit, but I just assumed it was, you know, a nurse within the hospital.
And certainly, you know, you could train a random nurse to collect a kit because it is in and of itself just a procedure. But there's so much more that goes along with collecting that kit. And a lot of our patients opt to not have evidence collection. Instead, they just want documentation. They want an assessment. They want a risk assessment for sexually transmitted infections or pregnancy or referrals to counseling, right? Many times the kit isn't part of it, or a lot of people don't want to report to law enforcement for valid reasons.
And then if you're seeing like a shot or a knife victim, are you having to like stitch them up and do all that too? Are you healing them and then talking to them?
You know, we provide a lot more one-on-one than, say, the ER nurse. Concurrently, an ER nurse or staff will be treating that wound, cleaning, suturing, right? So they're doing that piece, the purely medical piece, and then we'll address the issues that are specific to that. So medical does come first. We want to make sure that, you know, we're not going to say delay surgery just to collect evidence, right? But we will partner, and, you know, I've gone into the OR just as they're about to perform surgery because we want to preserve that evidence, right? So as soon as a surgery occurs, you know, there's cleaning that happens to get the body prepped. Ideally, you know, we'll be in there to take a picture before, swab to preserve that DNA, and then they can go and clean and stitch, and then we'll take a photograph afterwards.
Okay. Yeah, because I didn't even think of bite marks and stuff like that.
Exactly.
Say you get a positive like DNA extraction. How do you find out who that person is.
So we'll collect the kit, the evidence, and if they're working with law enforcement, right, then law enforcement takes the kit and then it goes to our crime laboratory and gets processed. And that's outside of the realm of the hospital. They will process pieces of from that kit based on high probability of where DNA will be found. So they don't test everything in the kit. They will test, oh, if there was a vaginal salt and there's vaginal swabs, I'm going to test that first. And if there's a foreign DNA found outside of what belongs to the patient, they do upload or run it in CODIS, which is the national database for offender profiles. And that's how they can determine if there's a match. How something gets entered into CODIS is through FBI rules. I know that much from our crime lab.
Okay. Yeah. So like if it's just a Joe Schmo who has no record, no whatever, and no prior anything, they would need to find him somehow to then get his DNA to test it against if he's not within that system.
Right. So there might be a DNA profile, but they don't know who it belongs to.
I wonder if there's like, since it's in the system somewhere and say 20 years down the road, something happens and they catch someone, would they be able to find that evidence from 20 years back?
Our crime lab DNA supervisor, I think, was involved in a case very similar to what you described, where there was like a cold case here in Wisconsin back, some 20 years ago. And they eventually found the perpetrator. It was a sexual assault / homicide case. And they found it from a DNA profile that they were able to lift off of old evidence and link into CODIS through genealogy, like through some fancy technology that they use to identify, you know, family members who share DNA and then ruling it down to like a brother and then going from there.
That's wild.
Yeah. It's super interesting.
That is, because I would think that there would be a lot of those. Not every person has a prior record.
Has there been a case that you've worked that has stuck with you and kind of changed maybe who you are, your perception of the world?
You know, there's a case that stands out for me. And when I think back about why that is, because I like to say, you know, any aspect of nursing is hard. Many nurses would say, how can you do this work? And I'm like, well, how can you do hospice nursing? Like, you know, there's always aspects that are like hard, right? But this case stuck with me. And when I looked back as to why, I think it was because the victim was a young girl. She was 12 or 13. She was the same age as my daughter. Not only that, but she kind of looked like my daughter. Their family dynamic was very, very similar. She lived in the town just over, very similar to us. And I think that's why it hit me more, because I identified with her more. Whereas some of my other patients, I'm able to keep that distance. Like, this is them. I am me. I'm treating you. I'm a nurse. I'm professional, right? And maintain that professional distance. What struck me about her was just her vulnerability, how this could so easily happen to a young teen and the ramifications. And then, you know, how the parents, like, it's hard, you know, it's your child and what happened. And her assault was recorded on social media and,
oh my gosh,
you know, the parents learning about that. And I just, it was hard. The dynamics are really what stuck with me. And I worried about the girl, like, oh my gosh, you know, she needs a trauma counselor. There was other issues prior to this that, in my view, led up to this, you know, and nobody saw it. And,
yeah,
you know, so that stuck with me more. And I still think about her and wonder how she is.
Yeah. How does that affect your parenting? I feel like you said, when you see a victim that comes in that could very well have been your own child, I feel like I would never want my kids to leave, ever. Like,
yeah,
Rapunzel, you're in the tower situation.
Or, I mean, you know, like I said, Milwaukee, like, I know all the bars that victims were drugged at.
Yeah.
Yes. Oh, I didn't even think about that. But yeah, you know, all the locations these people were coming from.
But as far as how it changed my parenting, I mean, like, I feel like I talked to my kids early and and often about consent. I have twins. I have a boy and a girl, you know, so I talk to them about that, what that means repeatedly. Social media. At one point, though, I remember my daughter a couple of years ago made the comment to me. We were arguing about who she was friending on Snapchat, right? That's when I started to lose control about who she's friending, right? Because it's just one big whoop, you know. And she made the comment. She said, not everyone is a predator. That hit me like, okay, maybe I am being too, you know, like I'm taking this home too much and I'm viewing the world through this lens. So that stuck with me a little bit. And so at this point, you know, they're 16, they're going to be 17 soon. And there comes a point where you just have to kind of trust, you know, that you've done enough and that they understand and just keep having those conversations. But they know what I do. They've known what I've done for a long time. When my pager would go off, they would sigh and say, why do people rape other people? You know, even at 10 years old.
Yeah.
I think they kind of know what that is. I think to the point almost where, you know, maybe they're not as exploratory with, you know, sex as their peers. I think they probably haven't done as much as some of their peers. And that's okay. You know, they'll come around.
Yeah.
There's no rush, you know.
There's no rush.
With my kids, I mean, they're younger, 11 and 9, but like, I've always just told them from the very beginning, like, you don't walk off with strangers. This is what happens at the strangers' houses, and it's not fun. I feel like they need to know what that means and what happens, you know?
Or have a safe place. I even tell my kids, if ever you are upset here, right, and there's something going on and you get that inkling to run away or leave, don't. I give them a number like, here, call Pathfinders. It's a really great organization in Milwaukee for runaway youth. I don't want them on the street. Within 48 hours, they will be approached by a trafficker, right? So it's like, I know that. Yeah. And I tell them that, like, no, call a different trusted parent. Call this agency. If you can't reach out to me, that's okay. Go to someone else that is, you know, trustworthy. And so they have that information too. So, you know, maybe that came from what I've seen, these girls who are on the street for longer than 48 hours and then they're in a trafficking situation. I think more parents should just be open to that. Like, you might not be the one that they're going to talk to, and that's okay, but direct them to where they can go.
Maybe it's just how you're brought up, but I was brought up with, like, we never really talked about anything, but I'm trying to be different with, you know, my kids, because we've had a couple incidences, like when my younger son, when we were at a jumpy place and he wandered off, but I kind of had to lay it down and tell him, like, this is what happens. You know, you'll be in someone's house and this is what they're going to do to you. And might've been extreme at 5, but you're not there to have a fun day and have a fun time, you know?
Exactly. Even at that age. And that's why I'm such a proponent too of teaching correct anatomy to young kids, using the terms vulva, vagina, penis, instead of made up names, because it keeps them safer. If somebody who shouldn't be touching them, they're not able to disclose, you know, because it's a mystery. It's, you know, something shameful. We shouldn't be talking about that. No.
I agree with that. My sister-in-law is a preschool teacher. And she had a little girl a couple years ago that just kind of showed some signs of trauma or something going on at home. She would be terrified to go into the restrooms by herself, and she would scream and throw these fits. And so one day she was just sitting with her and kind of trying to talk to her about, you know, why she's afraid or whatever. And she basically was saying that her uncle was doing stuff to her bottom, but she didn't call it her bottom. She called it something else. And so, you know, my sister-in-law went to the principal to report it, and they, you know, called child services. And basically child services told her, well, because she didn't say butt or bottom or, you know, anus, any of the appropriate words, we can't really do much about that because she didn't say. My sister-in-law was like flabbergasted that it was like, she's 5, like she's not going to say those things. And so I've always been the same with you. Like, I just, they are what they are. That's the correct terminology for them, you know, and you need to know what it is so that you can explain correctly if something happened.
Right. I mean, age appropriate language, of course, but for sure, you know, part of our role is community education as well, and outreach when we're not seeing patients. And we talk about these subjects, you know, our whole goal is to reduce violence in the community, right? And we try to drill that home as well to community groups, parents, patients.
Do you ever see women that repeatedly come in because they're being abused by a spouse? And I feel like that would just be the most frustrating situation.
Yes, we do. You know, it takes an average of 7 attempts for a woman to successfully leave a domestic violence situation. Many times, too, my patients I see have been strangled by their partner. You know, our research has found that a strangulation attempt, you know, while it wasn't fatal in that moment, that male will likely kill her. Some of those men also go on to become mass shooters as well. So they are a danger. But when we see those patients, we do have a tool, a screening tool called a danger assessment. This was developed by Dr. Jackie Campbell, who was a pioneer in domestic violence for women. And we use that screening tool to kind of help show patients what their lethality is if they return to the situation. Not so much to, you know, get them to leave right then and there, because we know the dynamics. It's difficult. Some of them, you know, they rely on their husband for the finances and they can't leave. They have children, housing, you know.
Yeah, it's complicated.
Yeah, you know, can at least tell them like, hey, this is where you're at, and we can help them perhaps safety plan.
They're kind of doing that with, I do hair, and they're starting to do training courses for us to kind of recognize like domestic abuse or women or children or whoever it is, like in situations, because people tend to tell us a lot of stuff, good and bad. But
that's amazing that they're training you on that, because I mean, it takes a village, right? So if they disclose to somebody. We're working on that, I think, just nationwide, like how to better address that and have people more prepared to respond to those things, or having the resources more publicly available.
This is just a question I wanted to see if you could shed some information on, just in case anyone's listening that's in a position like that. When they do come in for domestic violence, are they able to, I guess, file a police report without their spouse knowing, so that there's some sort of documentation of their injuries? How could they maybe take steps so that there's some sort of paper trail of what happened without their spouse finding out or anything like that, if they're worried about that?
That's a great question. So that is one benefit to coming and seeing a forensic nurse for those circumstances. So they can, you know, when they see us, because we do such an extensive history, you know, more than an ER nurse would, on top of just screening, like then we ask more detailed questions about the nature of the violence in the home and the dynamics of it and injuries and the history. So we will document all that. So that's documented. It's in their medical record and confidential. So that would be, you know, an extent, a paper trail for them.
Okay.
You know, if they were to want to keep this confidential in the moment and only act when they're ready to. If they were to involve law enforcement, at least in Wisconsin, law enforcement has a statute where there's a mandatory arrest of one party in a domestic dispute.
Okay.
So they would have to respond, right? So, but by coming to us without involving police, we can keep that record for them.
The other thing that's going through my head is like, if I was in these rooms listening to these stories, I don't know how I myself wouldn't break into tears and like start crying of just pure empathy for these individuals.
Yeah, sometimes it's hard. Some have made me tear up. Others, you know, have not. It's been more, I've just been able to take care of him or her.
Yeah.
And, you know, and that's happened to the best of us, where we have tears and the patient sees those tears, and that's okay. They sense our compassion and empathy, and it just adds to them wanting to confide in us and help them. And once, especially when they understand what our role is, you know, we don't have to involve law enforcement, and this is what we can offer you. And just that one-on-one presence supporting them is huge.
Do you ever have the parents that want, or the loved one that wants to talk to you afterwards? Are you able to talk to them?
So with parents, you know, like with minor children, yes, we do talk to the parents. If it's an adolescent, we will talk to the child alone about the nature of the assault, because again, that's a more pure disclosure.
Mm-hmm.
Similar to when doctor's offices like to ask about sexual activity or drug use without the parents, like they're probably going to be more inclined to tell you. In Wisconsin, teenagers have the right to receive our services, medications for sexually transmitted infections, and emergency contraception without parental consent. It's good because, you know, eventually the parent will find out, right? They are minors. They can request their medical records. They will be involved in, you know, if there's a law enforcement investigation. So obviously the parents are going to find out. But the spirit of the law, the way I see it, is it allows that minor in that moment to get the emergency services they need without jeopardizing their health. So emergency contraception, like, that's timely. They need that then and there, they'll get it, and there won't be anything to stop them. And so there's been a few ruffled, you know, conversations with parents who didn't want their children to have those medications, but the child wanted it, and I will give it. And I, you know, have conversations with the parents and say, look, I'm sorry, I'm a parent myself. I can understand, you know, because they've never been in this situation, right? So they're like, this is my child, I make medical decisions. Yes, but not in this case. And really, we should focus on, this is what your child needs. Let's focus on that, right? They need STI medication for a reason. They need emergency contraception for a reason. And we'll deal with the after effects and everything that happened later, but I will be giving the medication. It's a hard conversation to have. Just being supportive and firm with the parents has helped.
Yeah, because I would assume that even some of that would be maybe a religious aspect too.
There is, yep. There's misconceptions about emergency contraception. It's not an abortion pill. It's purely designed to prevent fertilization, right? So, you know, it's not going to affect implanted embryo. And we often have to have those discussions with patients themselves, you know, for their own religious beliefs. They're worried about, you know, that. Or even the concept, some of these patients think, oh gosh, I'm no longer, you know, quote, a virgin. That's hard. You know, we can't solve that in the moment. But I just try to tell patients, look, you know, I personally feel the concept of virginity is just that, a social construct, that you're not changed because of this man. This event changed you. Obviously, it's a trauma. And so you will learn from it. It'll change how you view the world. But fundamentally, you are still the same person. And virginity or sex is something you give to somebody. That concept is something that you decide. But those are, you know, you can't solve that in a 4-hour office visit.
Yeah. You kind of have to have a little bit of therapy with your job too.
Yeah. You have to, you know, say the right things. You can't just swoop in and out, you know, like an emergency room nurse, you know, has other patients to attend to. That's why these visits take as long as they do, you know, the assault history in itself, and then the issues around it. And patients have a hard time describing what happened to them in the alleyway. And they cry, and, or they don't cry, right? And they're just balled up on the couch, or they're very animated, you know, there's all different responses, and just allowing them the time and space to say what they need to say.
It's fantastic what you do.
And we need more forensic nurses, that's for sure. A lot of the nurses who come into this work start off with, you know, they were nurses, but they had an interest in forensic stuff.
Yeah.
And when they learned about this, like, well, this, you know, this is a nice blend.
Yeah, it really is.
I'm talking to the crime lab. I'm talking with prosecutors. I'm, you know, working with law enforcement, and your partners are different, you know, than they were in the hospital. In the hospital, you have lab and you've got, you know, radiology. And with us, we've got all these external partners, and you learn to work together, and it's really cool. I love it. I mean, I've always kind of been interested in, you know, the criminal justice system slightly, or even the legal system, you know, so testifying in court, I used to be scared of it, and now I enjoy it. It's like educating somebody, you're talking to the jury, and I like seeing the difference I make in my patients in that moment. So I can see the difference, however minute, in these patients when they leave, to just have somebody dedicated to them for 4 hours to reassure them that everything is okay, or this is what you can do, or help broach law enforcement with them. And
comforting.
Yes. And, you know, who would want somebody collecting evidence from their vagina, not from a nurse? Yeah. You know, it's like, of course. And same goes for suspects. Like, we do see suspects. Law enforcement will bring suspects into the hospital to have DNA collected via a court order or a subpoena. And sometimes those suspects are like, no, I don't want you to swab, you know, my penis. Law enforcement's like, okay, that's fine. So either the nurse will do it or I will. And most suspects will look at, you know, officer so-and-so, and then they'll just be like, okay, yeah. I'd rather this nice nurse, you know, swab my penis. Yeah. And so they do, because we're kind and gentle, and they're our patient.
Yeah.
So we will treat them with dignity and respect and all that, so.
With what you do, the picturing, like, I wish there was a program that, like, they get, like, a stuffed animal or something to hug or something while they're doing the process.
Yes, they do. That's part of our repertoire, especially where I used to work. Yes, stuffed animals, comfort items. My daughter used to paint little message rocks.
Okay. Yeah, because I was thinking about that. I'm like, oh, I wish I could, like, donate my kids' stuffed animals to something like that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Or we could always use, you know, clean brand new underwear, because when we take patients' clothing, right, we have to give them something to wear out.
Oh my God. I didn't even think about that.
Yes. So we often have replacement clothing, new stuff, anything, tops, bottoms, sports bras, underwear to maintain their dignity. Many places, hospitals have showers for them, because if they come to us right from the scene, we collect their evidence. Great. Now they just want a shower. And they can take as long as they want in that shower. And we offer them shampoo and conditioner and toothbrush.
Like a little slice of home. How would I go about finding? I just would call, like, maybe the hospital and see if they have a program that would take a donation.
Call the hospital, or in your state, you know, Google sexual assault programs or forensic nurse programs, and it should bring up a list of hospitals in your area, or certainly advocacy agencies would know, okay, like, where are the sane sexual assault nurse examiner programs or forensic nurse programs, and they could point you to, because they're scattered throughout the nation, but we all practice the same way. We follow the same standards.
I would think that even just a little thing like that would be comforting. Even if you're over 18, I would want to snuggle a bear.
Yep. I worked side by side with a trauma counselor, and she would see patients with me in the moment. And during the exam, she would ask, you know, what's your favorite animal? And they're like, oh, you know, a cat. And then she'd go and find one of our new stuffed kitties and bring it to the patient. And she would just, like, light up, like, oh my gosh. And she would just hug that little stuffy, and it would get her through.
That warms my heart. I'm glad that that is a thing.
Is there a misconception that maybe you want to clear up for anyone listening that ever is, like, debated going into a hospital to seek out any sort of help?
But there's so many misconceptions, like how to choose. There's so many misconceptions. I'd say some of the bigger ones that come to mind are that when you come to the hospital for this type of exam, that means you are reporting to law enforcement. And that is not true. Coming to us doesn't mean you're reporting the crime.
Okay.
The other big one is that, you know, we cannot tell what happened to you. We can't look at you and say, oh, yep, there was a penis there. You know, we can't do that. We can see, you know, like, oh, there's some injuries there. We can't make a determination where they came from, because some of those injuries, like I mentioned, can come from other things, tampons, your own fingers, right? So we can't make a determination. We can say, oh, those findings are consistent with what you're telling me, but we can't make a determination. We also can't, you know, if we are swabbing for DNA and collecting that kit, we don't know those results right then and there. We're swabbing and sending it to the crime lab, and that's a process. And the other thing, the hymen is probably the most misunderstood piece of anatomy in the female genitalia. People are often thinking, okay, well, if I had sex, especially if it's a prepubescent girl or adolescent, like, well, her hymen will be missing. That is a myth. The hymen, think of it like a scrunchie that we use for hair. It's circular and encircles the vaginal opening and doesn't cover the vaginal opening completely. So the first time you have intercourse, it's not necessarily broken. And in fact, many hymens we see have no injuries whatsoever.
Wow.
The whole concept of an intact hymen or whatever is a myth. So those are probably the top misconceptions. That, and also that, you know, physicians do these exams, like on TV. We all love SVU, all of us in this discipline. Mm-hmm. We love Olivia Benson. She has a foundation that works for survivors, so we love her. But, you know, the misconception is that they bring the patient in via law enforcement to the hospital, and they're like, well, she's going to have a rape kit. What were the rape kit results? The doctor is not going to be doing that exam. It's going to be a nurse always. And, you know, if the law enforcement asked us, well, you know what happened? Not only do I need consent, but assuming I did have consent to talk to the officer, I'd say, well, these were my findings. Like, she had a scratch, she had a laceration down there. You know, we collected a kit. Here you go. Those are probably the top five.
Do you ever have people that come back to you that maybe you treated the night of their assault that reach out to you later down the line to thank you?
Not directly. We've learned of survivors who say will be in touch with an advocacy organization throughout their journey and then will comment like, you know, I'm really grateful for the help I got, you know, at the hospital or whatever. But what we found is when those patients come in by us, that visit is a blur.
Like surreal, like they're not even there.
Yes. They, you know, most people can only remember three things anyway from, you know, a hospital when a doctor's talking to you or a nurse telling you what to, you know, your education, what you need to do. But what they do remember is how they felt. So many times they don't remember what we did or even like, did they collect evidence? You know, they'll have to look back at their paperwork to know, but they will remember, gosh, yeah, I felt okay in that space, or I felt safe, or that nurse was kind.
Well, you do some amazing work, Susie, and I don't know how you do it. You are a warrior.
Oh, well, thank you. The results we see on our patients, I think, is what continues to drive us to move on and keep doing this and just knowing that we're making a difference. That's all nurses want to do, is we want to make a difference, and we can see it with these patients. And when we know to look for it, especially if you're new and you're like, I don't know, you know, I need that guilty verdict. You know, you might not get that.
Yeah.
And that's not why we're there. We're there for the patient. And when we look for it and we can see it, then it feeds our soul.
Mariah, you want to do the fun questions?
Susie, we're going to switch over and just do some lighthearted, silly questions just to kind of end on a warm and fuzzy note. It'll be our equivalent to a stuffed animal. What's your favorite snack?
I'm more of a savory person, so I'd have to say probably like cheese.
Ooh, okay. What do you eat when you're at work and you're on your shift?
Yeah, at work. Well, then it's like pretty much whatever I can get from the vending machine. So I try not to eat that stuff anymore and try to like plan ahead and bring healthy things, but usually it's that. At times it's been super rewarding to, you know, I just had a long patient and now I get to sit down and chart. My patient's gone and we'll order a pizza. And there's nothing more satisfying than knowing that you don't have another patient. You can just sit down and chart and dedicate your time and brain power to your charting while eating pizza.
Pizza, especially when you could sit and enjoy it, is always nice.
For sure.
I always like to ask everybody this one is what's something that you hoard?
Oh, coffee cups. Yeah, I've got a thing with coffee cup. Like, we like to purchase a coffee cup from some place that we've traveled to.
Aw, fun.
I find that like coffee tastes better in certain cups. Like, I just have like this thing.
I like that one. I haven't heard a coffee cup collection. And I do like that it tastes different in each mug.
It does. Yes.
What is one of your hobbies?
Strangely, photography. Couple of years ago, my husband purchased a DSLR camera for me. I wanted to take pictures of my kids, you know, and just learn how to do that. I took some online courses about how to shoot in manual mode and adjust the aperture and stuff. And when I have free time and when I want to, my kids even sometimes ask to be photographed. So I do that.
Nice. That's a fun hobby.
Okay, this is a random one, Susie. When you're getting ice out of the refrigerator and some of the ice falls onto the floor, do you pick it up or do you kick it under the fridge?
So our fridge is on a hardwood floor, but then adjacent is like the opening to our garage and we have linoleum there. So I'll kick it to the linoleum. Because I don't want the hardwood floor to have it.
It's so much easier than like picking it up. You just kick it over.
Right.
If you were cast in a true crime series, who would play you?
Oh my gosh. So in my younger years, people used to think I look like Sandra Bullock.
Okay.
Oh, that's a good one.
Yeah, I would choose probably her.
She would do a good job, I think. I love her. Okay, I think I'll end with, what's your favorite holiday?
Oh gosh. Halloween.
Oh, that's mine too.
Yeah, Halloween. We love fall and all that goes along with it. I just don't like winter, but yeah, Halloween. We got married in October.
You did? Oh,
yeah.
That's so cool.
I picture it like probably in Wisconsin. I picture it like Hocus Pocus.
Oh, totally. Yep. That's really pretty much what it ends up to be around. Occasionally, sometimes it's like a stiff wind will come and blow all the leaves off. And then it's like suddenly looks like winter. But for the most part, yeah, it looks like that.
Feel Halloween-y.
Yes.
All right. Well, thank you. Thank you for talking to us.
We really appreciate it. And I learned so much and I really have so much respect for what you do.
Oh, well, thank you. And thank you for the opportunity. I really enjoyed it.
That's a hard, hard job. Like, I feel like my chest feels like a little tight. Like, I feel a little stressed.
I don't feel like that. I feel like she does, like I feel like a warm snuggle from a stuffed animal.
No, I don't feel like that. I mean, she feels like that. Like, her personality is so endearing and kind and sweet. But I literally feel really? So stressed. I just couldn't imagine absorbing all of that trauma. I think it would really change my personality. Like, honestly, like, I think I would cry all the way home, coming home from work. I think I'm too emotional for a job.
I think
like
I would cry too, but I feel like I could maybe do that job.
I mean, I would love to be a badass and think that I could do that job because I think what she's doing is really amazing. And I love that it definitely, like she said, it combines the like people care with like the science, which I think is rad. But I think you'd have to count me out.
Feel like I felt sick when we did autopsy.
See, I felt the opposite. I think that's so
you
cool,
felt like a warm, like snuggly bear.
Not warm like a bear and like I'm cozy and I want to settle in, but more like I'm going to see a brain and that's when am I ever going to see a brain? When am I ever going to see like an organ exposed or like peeling skin back? To me, the science behind all of that drives it so much that I don't think about, this is all hypothetical because I could pretty much get in that room and maybe just hit the floor. So who knows for sure?
No.
But I don't think that I could handle the emotional toll.
I feel like I could handle the emotional toll. I don't know why. Like I told you, people will come up and just yak with me at the store like,
well, I mean, the hairdresser's cape is like a magical thing because you really do put your guard down. Like some of the stories I've told my hair people, I'm like, why did I tell them that? Like, you know, like I know I don't hang out with them. They don't know me. Like, you know what I mean? But you feel just
like warm
you're
and
on
fuzzy.
Your therapist couch.
Yeah.
100%.
I just saw this meme that was saying it was like, if my hairdresser sees you, she hates you too because she knows everything about you. Like, it was like,
that's so true.
But the only aspect of this job that I think I couldn't do, the veggie talk, like.
You get so weirded out. I think you just need to say it over and over. Vagina.
Oh, I was dying.
I'm just going to make you an audio tape of me saying all the proper genitalia terms so you can like fall asleep too.
Like nipple. Like what? No.
Think about the nature of questions that she has to ask. Like, did X and X penetrate X and X? Like, think about, I can't have that conversation with somebody because I wouldn't be able to stomach it. Yeah, it's too awful.
Yeah.
But I will say, and I think everybody that listened to this episode should reach out to their local hospitals or Google forensic nursing in your area. Because I'm going to go buy a bunch of panties and take them to the hospital.
And a couple bears.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't even think about that. But like, how humiliating.
That's
like,
what I mean.
You have to like leave with like some paper underwear they give you.
I know.
You know, so like, thank God that they're giving them
or
a
like
change
that
of clothes.
Mesh underwear they give you after you have a baby.
Please.
No.
Yes.
No. I just know that like when my kids, like, especially, you know, my younger one, he, you know him with his bears, he loves them.
Yep.
And I just pictured like, he just needs his blue bear.
I mean, I think even me, when I get anxious, I need a fluffy pillow.
Right.
Like, I literally have to like cuddle a fluffy pillow because I'm like on the edge of like having a breakdown. So in that room, I would want a fluffy pillow to hold on to and like shove against my stomach. Because the reality, like, because you would think that you're in there alone. Because if I was married, I am married. If this happened to me, I wouldn't want Will in there. Like, I wouldn't want him to hear.
Yeah, I feel like I would be holding back because I would be holding back.
Yep.
Because of their feelings. You don't want to hurt
them. Yeah. Exactly. So I'm going to need the blanket, the fluffy pillow, and Susie so that I can get through. But I feel stressed right now. I really do. This one is the first one I think that has literally stressed me out.
Like when your spit's getting a little bit thinner.
Yeah, like I really feel this like tightness on my chest and this kind of like anxious feeling.
Oh, I'm glad you finally have experienced that. Yeah.
But isn't it ironic that it's the emotional stuff that makes me anxious?
There's something wrong with that.
What does my therapist gonna say about that?
You know, that is ironic.
Right? I mean, oh, I've been told I get really uncomfortable with displays of emotion. Jaya, she always is telling me, like, I just like to see you squirm when I tell you how much I love you.
Oh, see, I don't like that stuff either.
It makes me uncomfortable.
Like, my family was never a hugger family, but I almost feel like Daddy's Home too. Like, have you seen that movie? Like, there's the Will Ferrell family, and then there's that are like kissing at the airport, and then there's the other family that's like, hey. And I feel like, and I feel like I was brought up with the Hay family. So then I feel like I'm too old to incorporate, like we can't even go there because we missed our window.
It's too late. Yeah, the ship
is sailed. But I can talk to you. So maybe that's why. But then I feel like it's circumstantial. So if I have a kid or an adult who's just gone through this experience and they need a hug, then it's appropriate for me to hug you. I don't need to hug you every Tuesday when I see you.
You don't need a hug with the greeting. Yeah, no.
Or leaving. You're good. Like, I'm leaving.
I'll see you later.
Why do I got to hug you?
Yeah, I get that.
I don't
that.
Even think I have hugged you in my life knowing you. Have we?
I don't know. I don't think so.
I don't think we have.
You're not a memorable hugger, I guess, because if we did, I didn't remember it.
But if you were hurting and you needed a hug, I would give you that hug.
Well, I appreciate that. Yeah. I don't need a lot of like physical touch.
Yeah, that's not your language, your love
not
language.
At all. Not
what was
at
yours?
All.
Acts of love? Like presents?
Yeah, gifts.
And mine is doing something, acts of love. I get uncomfortable when people give me presents. I don't like that.
You don't like it? See, but I love to give presents. I think sometimes
I'm
more
do.
Excited about giving the present.
Yeah.
Then
you love
ever
a present.
Getting them. I just love to give.
That's
presents.
Where I think your thoughtfulness comes in. So maybe you can be the and work in this aspect, but you can be the.
I'll go get the teddy bear.
You could be the
I'll
bear
go get
girl.
You the bear. You want a bear, a blanket, peanut butter M&Ms. What do you need?
Yeah, you're
that I can do.
And maybe there's a need for you.
That's also fix my personality. Like, I'm a fixer. Like, let me get in here and make you feel better. But I don't want to talk. I don't want to hear about it. I can't absorb it. You're going to have to talk to Nikki.
Until we get to the anatomy part and then I'm out.
And then we'll swap. Yeah. We'll bring
then
in
we
a
need
third
to
person.
Swap. Because there was a lot
we'll bring
of.
Bring Susie in so we can just like, we'll have a nice little triangle system.
But I think that she is all three and that's the magic. You need to
that
be all three.
That is magic. It's magic.
Yeah.
Like,
you need
she
to be all
really
three.
Is. An incredible human
And I really
being.
Am going to look into where I could do a bear. Because that just like my heart hurts.
Well, if we find anything good, we'll link it on the episode notes. But we definitely would encourage you listeners to check in your home states. But if we do find something that is a nationwide program that you can donate to, we'll link it up.
All right. I'm so glad finally you got one you can't handle.
Just please no more of these emotional ones. Let's go back to the blood and guts and gore because that I can handle all day.
All right.
Till next time.
Bye.
Thank you so much for listening and supporting us. We do encourage you to follow us at Instagram at Body to Burial. Hit us up on Twitter at Body to Burial. And you guessed it, you can send us an email to hello@bodytoburial.com.
If you have any guest suggestions, just let us know. Please hit the subscribe button or follow button on whatever app you are listening to.
Thanks so much, guys. See you next time.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.